No, I understand. I'm excited. You're right, we need a doctor. I think Kelly will be a fantastic resource for both human and animal well-being. But to have a surgeon? Wow. It's like we lucked into an even better situation than we realized. I planned on attending medical school. I would love to learn from you if I can, Rebecca said from the back of the room. I have little interest in farming. It's not a package deal, is it? Matt jumped in before Melanie could respond. I'm excited about the farming. I know I'm signed up to help Greg with the trapping and hunting, but I've been studying farming for the last few months. I'd been lucky to work with both of you, Melanie told them. Did I raise the question none of us wanted to ask? How long are we going to stay here? She looked around the room. I'm tired. I've been fighting to survive and keep my kids alive for half a year. We lived through the stress of the rapture, through months of confusion and struggle. I want to settle down for a few weeks, get our bearings. I don't know how we decide where to go and when to go there, but I'd like to vote on staying here for at least 2 more weeks, maybe a month. We probably have enough moose meat to last us that long. Do we even have to vote? John asked. We all feel the same way. 2 weeks is an easy decision. I think the bigger question is if we stay the summer. I don't know if gas will work at the end of the summer. You're talking another 5 or 6, maybe 7 months? If we don't have gas, we have to walk out of New Hampshire. That will be a problem. Todd brought realism to the vacation plans. I don't want to discuss our next destination. I just want to talk about how long we stay here. We all okay with 2 weeks? John asked. No one replied. Anyone not want to stay here for 2 weeks? The room was silent again. Okay, John said. We stay, relax, get our energy, put some pounds on you New Yorkers, reassess the situation in 2 weeks. Everyone was quiet. The group had established daily tasks, assigned them to qualified people, decided on a short-term timeline. It was a good meeting. Todd, who sat down after the conversation began to flow, stood. Does anyone have any additional business? Anything they want to talk about? I want to lead a party down to Boston. Look for survivors, John announced. I was against approaching people, going to major cities. I was against finding all of you, and I was wrong. I want to give any survivors in Boston a chance to join us. I assume it will be a day trip, maybe overnight. I can take the Suburban. I would like to go with you, Solange said, standing up to join him. Any long trip, or any task we do that is away from our home, we should do in pairs. Does anyone have a problem with us going down to Boston? John asked again. If you can help people, it's the right thing to do. If you can save people like you saved us, I'll pack your food for you. Bernie gave John the support he was looking for. Okay. Solange and I will leave in 2 days. The snow might be off the highways by then. Todd continued. Well, that was productive and expedient. It's only been about an hour. Do we want to talk about long-term plans? I know we just said we would hang out for 2 weeks, which is great. But do we want to discuss our long-term goals? Rebecca raised her hand. You can just speak, Rebecca, Todd told her. Everyone knows I've run analysis of where we should go. Some of you know my findings, that the coast of Virginia is probably our best spot, except if we can get to Hawaii or some other tropical island. There are 2 ways we can get to the islands. We drive to California and figure out how to work a large boat, which I conclude is improbable. She paused and looked at Peter. Or we fly. Fly? How are we going to fly? Ahmed asked. I'm a pilot. Retired Navy. Retired commercial. Peter spoke loudly, clearly, and with the confidence expected from a pilot. If there is a plane that works, I can get it in the air. Our issues are fuel and capacity. Capacity for people and supplies, as well as capacity for fuel and distance.
You have a doctor and a pilot? Ahmed asked.
We have a doctor and a pilot. John emphasized the we.
I love that we are talking about this, and I want nothing more than to live in Hawaii. But let's also discuss a third capacity that Peter is not discussing. The capacity to land. What if we fly to Honolulu and the airport is in ruins, or there are planes blocking the runways? Honestly, I don't see that as an issue, Peter told them. I doubt the airports on every island will be destroyed or unavailable for landing. If they are, which again is not realistic, there will be a stretch of highway somewhere we can use. Could we end up landing on the highway in the lava fields on Kona? Possibly. But there are 3 airstrips on Oahu alone. The military would never leave the airstrip blocked. We can land at Pearl if we needed to. Is it a risk? Yes. Is it a big risk? No. Paul nodded as Peter explained the options. Okay, I'm appeased. You're good. Son, you have no idea. Peter winked at him.
Seriously? Rebecca said with exasperation. I did all this work, and the answer is Hawaii? Everyone in the room would have said Hawaii without turning on a computer. Unbelievable.
We were bored. It kept us busy, Paul told her. He knew her venom was directed at him.
Kelly stood. I like the idea, and I understand why Hawaii presents so many benefits to us. Climate, water, food, safety. The list continues.
Are we concerned about being stuck there? If we fly to Honolulu, I doubt there's a way to return. We're done. If supplies are not as abundant as we think they are, we're looking at New York City all over again.
Rebecca answered, The ocean will not run out of fish. The tropical fruit alone can sustain us, but I assume we're going to bring seeds to plant, corn, wheat, rice, etc.
I agree. Flying to Hawaii means we're going there forever, for the rest of our lives. But you have to understand, if we settle in Virginia, we're making the same choice. Once our gas goes bad, we have to walk, bike, or ride a horse to get where we want to go.
Rebecca looked around the room and could tell some of her audience was not convinced.
I know it was 2 years ago, but think about the hurricane that plowed up the East Coast and took out all of those bridges and homes. Remember when the Mississippi River flooded 10 years ago? The water rushed over bridges and washed out roads. Just the freezing and thawing that occurs every year will ruin any bridge that was close to being replaced before all of this. In a few years, I doubt the highway system will be available. Trees will have fallen across most, if not all, of the roads. Vegetation in the warmer climates will consume everything. In 5 years, it will not be a simple feat to move. How do we get across the Connecticut River without a bridge? How do we get across the Mississippi? How do we traverse a highway littered with pine tree refuse?
She noticed nodding and mumbles of acceptance.
Wherever we go, that is where we will stay.
Rebecca did not mean to sound dour or foreboding, but the facts were the facts.
Is there a chance we could migrate from Virginia to some other place?
Sure.
But the odds would be small. Greater than if we moved to Hawaii, but small nonetheless.
Todd waited before he spoke. Look, this isn't a decision we need to make right now. Maybe we explore the options. See if there are any planes in Lebanon. Have John and Solange check the planes at Logan in Manchester. I brought up our long-term plans because I know we're all thinking about it. Kelly brings up a great point. Hawaii has finality to it. I'd like to drink cow's milk again at some point in my life. If we go to Hawaii, I'm not sure that's going to happen. Let's look into some of this stuff. Maybe continue the conversations informally.
I'm a good resource for a lot of these questions. For one, there are cows on almost all of the islands.
At least there were cows 8 months ago, Rebecca offered.
I've been studying Hawaii for a while. I can discuss Virginia and Northern California, too. Thanks to Paul, I can discuss just about anywhere we would consider settling. I'm really not as mean as Ahmed makes me out to be.
Avery laughed to support her new friend.
Okay, okay, that's enough laughing, Ahmed said. And she is as mean as I think she is, smarty pants.
John walked over to Peter.
Should you come with us to Boston?
Or are there things you can tell us to look for with regards to the type of plane we need? People began to engage in side conversations. The meeting appeared to be over. Rebecca spoke to Greg and Matt in the back of the room. Avery walked over to join them.
You go, girl. Look who's leading the group to paradise.
Rebecca blushed.
Thanks. And thanks for laughing at my lame joke.
It wasn't lame. You were taking a beating from Ahmed and people who felt you should have humored him more.
It's your time, Rebecca. It's our time. Teenagers rule.
Greg stared at Avery.
I'm Greg. I met you last night for like 2 seconds.
Nice to meet you again, Greg. I'm Avery. I met you with my friend Meredith, who's over talking to Kelly, the vet.
Avery turned towards Matt.
Hi, Matt. Nice to see you again.
Avery, pretty and confident, made shy Matt tongue-tied. Greg teased him.
Seriously, bro? We're not at a dance.
Yes, Avery, this is my shy brother, Matt. Matt managed a hi before elbowing Greg.
Dude, uncool.
Avery was used to boys being flustered around her. Matt was tall, thin, muscular, and handsome. She made sure to give him a smile to let him know it was okay he blushed.
So you are the other half of the team that lived up here?
She focused on Greg.
You have to tell me some stories. Did anything crazy happen? Did a bear chase you into a house? Did you see mountain lions or anything?
I take it you are one of the New York City people, Greg said with a smile. Didn't get out of the city much, huh?
You're making fun of me.
Yes, yes I am. No, we didn't have any wild animal encounters. We probably could have if we had been careless with food, but bears typically go to sleep in the winter.
Greg tried to catch a turkey, Rebecca started.
Seriously, again with the turkey story? Come on, at some point I have to live that story down.
Well, it's not today.
Rebecca recounted Greg's early adventures with hunting.
Looks like two of us didn't get out of the city much, Avery said to him after they stopped laughing.
Greg did not mind the ribbing. He was now a capable hunter and trapper. His early attempts were amusing. Even he laughed when Rebecca talked about running at a turkey with a hoe.
It's nice to be around other young people, Greg told them after a few minutes.
Rebecca and I were alone for a long time, and we couldn't be young, couldn't be kids. And then my uncles, man, they're old men. It's great to have my brothers and some other teenagers here.
Do you guys play tennis? Avery asked them.
I do, but I was way more into baseball. Matt was the tennis player. Greg used his shoulder to push Matt forward. I played in my parents' club league, but that's about it.
If we can find some rackets and get a court cleared off, I'd love to play a few sets. You can show me your stuff.
Avery winked at Rebecca to let her know not to tell the boys about her tennis past. Matt, over his initial awkwardness, was excited to spend time with Avery.
Sure. Hopefully in the next 2 weeks.
What should we do with the rest of the daylight? Avery asked them.
Is there anything that needs to get done?
Firewood, Greg and Matt said together.
Greg had an idea of filling a pickup truck with firewood and parking it down here, making it easier for people to come out and collect wood when they need it.
We have to find a pickup truck? Avery asked.
There are a bunch of pickup trucks parked behind one of the college buildings, a row of green utility vehicles just about a half mile from here. They'll work, assuming they start. The keys are hanging in the office where they're parked.
Antonio walked up to the group of young people and listened.
You should take one of the cars we have working. Use it to jump the truck. No way it will start without a jump.
Matt did not know Antonio very well and was happy for the advice.
Any chance you want to come along and help?
Yeah.
Antonio stuck out his hand.
Tony,
he said, introducing himself to Matt. Matt, taking Antonio's hand. This is my brother Greg and our friend Rebecca.
Hey.
Antonio flipped his head to Greg and shook his hand.
I know Rebecca from fishing. Her old man taught her how to fish just like mine.
Hey, he said to her.
Well, now that we know each other, let's get to it. I'll ask Meredith to come. She needs to get to know all of you.
Avery waved to Meredith.
Let's do it.
Matt walked over to the coat pile before making his way to the adults on the other side of the room.
Dad?
We're going to get some firewood for the houses. Anything else we should be thinking about? Can you grab your brother? He should help.
There are six of us already. Our plan is to fill a pickup bed with wood, park it down here. Craig and the other kids can distribute the wood to the fireplaces when we get back.
I like the way you think. See you when you get back. The young adults walked out of the house and towards the cottage. They needed gloves to avoid splinters. Matt and Greg, reunited for 3 days, used much of their time together to catch up. Rebecca was glad to have friends. She was never close to people her own age. It was amusing to her that Avery, a senior in high school, would be so friendly. The senior girls Rebecca met before would not acknowledge her. Rebecca was the curve buster, a freak blowing through their grade, a nerd. Today her intelligence was an asset, not a character flaw. Rebecca knew the circle of kids she walked with today was her peer group for the rest of her life, unless they started rounding up survivors or found more teens in Boston. She was walking with the same people she would see in 50 years. It was an odd realization. Thankfully, everyone is normal, she thought to herself.
43. The adults remained in the house after the kids left, enjoying the roaring fire. Emily spoke to Bernie and Melanie about developing a routine for the children. Emily enjoyed the every-other-day school system she used in Raleigh. Bernie and Melanie agreed to anything, as long as they did not have to teach. "We should turn off the movie and video games, take the kids over to the library, let them check out the building. Heck, it might not work for us. Better to find out this afternoon than to show up tomorrow expecting to have school. It's a beautiful day outside. Let's take a walk."
"I'm in," Melanie said, moving towards the shrinking pile of coats. "I could use a nice walk."
Bernie followed her over to the coats.
"You are a doctor."
"I'm a doctor from a hospital that had all the latest gadgets. I'm not sure I would know how to make a cast if we needed to. I'm used to having people do that for me. But I can diagnose the heck out of all of you," Melanie joked.
"How did this happen?" Bernie asked. "How did everyone die? Why couldn't you help?"
Melanie dropped her joke.
"It was too fast. It was just too damn fast." She walked ahead of Bernie and out the front door before stopping.
"As a person of God, I ask you the same question. Why was the world forsaken?"
Bernie shook her head, not offering an explanation. They waited silently for Emily to guide them towards the library.
"We're taking the kids over to the library to scout out the school situation," Emily said to Todd, interrupting his conversation. "We'll be back at some point."
"Okay, I'll see you. Have fun."
He gave her a kiss and turned back to his circle.
"Our best-case scenario is finding a loaded fuel truck. We will use it to fill the plane. But if the fuel is in a holding tank, we have to figure out a way to get power into that pump, get the fuel into the truck, and drive the truck to the plane." Peter explained airport fueling logistics to them. "If we don't find fuel, obviously we're done." Peter continued, "The issue is figuring out whether we land on the West Coast to refuel. It will depend on the type of plane we find, and if we want to take the risk of not finding fuel out there. What if we land in San Francisco and cannot find a fuel truck or fuel?"
"We have dozens of airports to explore. I'm positive we can find a plane and fuel. We might have to drive back to Raleigh to do it, but we can find something that will work," John assured everyone. "Seriously, Raleigh's airport is probably pristine and definitely has fuel."
Hank turned to Paul.
"Remember that dairy farm we kept talking about going to after the thaw? The Hummer should be able to brave the trek. Let's hit it tomorrow."
"The farm that ran tours?
You expect to find something?"
Todd knew the place. He took Jay and Brian there in the summer. The farm was a staple of his family visits to Hanover.
"If we don't find animals there, we can check the 100 dairy farms in and around here. Maybe some of the cows found hay stores. Maybe the grass poked through the snow in spots. I bet something survived."
Hank was convinced he could find livestock. "We should at least try.
I'm up for a trip, Paul told his brother. I'd like to come along. I can help with any sick animals. I did a rotation on a dairy farm. I know how to get dairy cows producing again. Kelly looked at Todd. We could be swimming in milk pretty quickly. One healthy cow, milked a few times each day, would give us 4 to 6 gallons of milk. That's just one cow. What are the odds we find a cow producing that much milk? Hank asked her, skepticism in his voice. Depends on everything you just said. If we do find a cow, we can get one producing with the right nutrition and food. If we find a few cows, we'll have enough milk and cheese for our group. More than enough. You have to realize, cows today have been bred to give enough milk for millions of people. When you only have 20 people to feed, one cow would overwhelm us with milk. Speaking of feeding 20-some-odd people, I'm going to grind some meat and make sausage for breakfast and dinner tomorrow. Hank gave the people on either side of him pats on the back as he headed towards the basement. I can help with that, Jamie called after him. I'm going to get an early jump on dinner, Todd announced. I'll light a fire in the oven and start on the bread. Fish stew is on the menu this evening. I want to make sure we mix up how we serve the trout.
I'll join you. I can fillet a trout like nobody's business. You leave too many bones.
Ahmed rubbed his hands in the fire, almost standing in the flames during the conversation. He, like the other New York people, was rail thin and had a hard time keeping warm. John, Solange, Peter, Paul, and Kelly remained in the living room.
It's a little after 3. I'm going to catch 40 winks. I'll need my strength for tomorrow, Peter said as he pushed himself out of his chair.
What is tomorrow? Solange asked him.
You, John, and I are going to the airport in the next town to look at airplanes. I'll show you what to look for at the airports in Manchester and Boston. We might have what we need already, and a plane could be a few miles away. He waved, taking his coat and heading out the door to his bedroom in another house.
No chance we can use a plane out of Lebanon. They're all turboprops. We'd have to land every hour to refuel, and it would only fit about 12 of us. It will be good for us to see what we need to look for in Manchester and Boston. I'm hoping Manchester will suit our needs.
John grabbed the end of a couch. Hey, help me move this in front of the fire.
Paul grabbed the end, and the two men moved the couch to the fire. They repeated the procedure with a second couch.
Dinner's being made. Firewood is being collected. The kids are in school. I heard a vote about relaxing for the next 2 weeks. I might take another nap, or at the very least relax in front of the fire. I have a busy next few days.
John kicked off his shoes and sat on one of the couches. He looked at the fire and the pile of wood in a bin next to it and nodded. Should be enough to keep me warm and happy for a few hours.
Solange and Kelly sat on the other couch. You do not expect to find cows alive, do you? How can a cow live through winter with no building or food?
They're animals. They survive. It's what they do. I bet a couple figured it out. I really do.
Kelly was confident they would find cows. Cows that were alive and would serve them well. The women started a long discussion, only part of which was heard by John. He was soon snoring next to them. Paul was not tired, but he did not have anything to do. He walked back to the cottage to let Hubba out and read a book.
44.
The Lebanon airport was a bust. Not only were the planes too small to accommodate a group of their size, the planes only had a short fuel range. There was a fuel truck in Lebanon, but it was a small truck with limited capacity, not enough fuel to fill a large jet.
It's a start, Peter said enthusiastically. We have fuel, and we could drive this truck down to Manchester or Boston if needed. It works. We can use it to fill a jet if necessary. It will take a few loads from this tank to fill a jet, but we can do it. Not an optimal solution, but a solution.
Peter was energized. Peter told stories on the way back from the airport, old war and flying stories. He lived an interesting life. His wife was able to join him on many of his longer layover trips. They enjoyed traveling the world. He was not a chatty person,
and his main point in telling the stories was to relay that he knew how to fly. He was good, and he could take them where they wanted to go. He needed the right equipment and a whole bunch of fuel, but he would get them to Hawaii. Peter learned a long time ago that one of a pilot's jobs was sell confidence and security to passengers. How are we supposed to get into a plane that's parked? Is there a handle on the door? And how are we supposed to tell if it's a 777? Are there markings on the plane? John drove back from Lebanon. The easiest way for you to tell. A 737 has 10 wheels, the 777 has 14. There are always two for the front set, that tiny arm that drops down. The back of the 777 will have 6 on each side, and the 737 will have 4 on each side. Is that it? Solange wrote down the tire numbers. The 777 is huge. It will be much, much bigger than any of the other planes. You're talking about a plane that can fly twice as far. It's going to be enormous next to the 737. Count the wheels, but really, you won't have to worry about figuring it out. Peter gave Solange a confident look. Look for airlines from Asia. Those will be 777s. Asia, the Middle East, they use the big planes. Those planes should be in Manchester and Logan. I followed the airlines when the rapture began. Everything was grounded. We didn't want the plague over here, and they didn't want the plague over there. Instead of saying, everyone get home, this is your last fight, countries canceled everything. Didn't even let the pilots bring the airplanes home. Do not forget South America. They might have big planes, too. Solange smiled at the older man, showing him her continental pride. You're right. There might be a Brazilian airplane at Logan. Look. Peter was sitting in the front seat and swung his arm over the back to give attention to both John and Solange. There are going to be planes there at both airports. Don't worry. We'll be able to move anything that's in our way for takeoff. Our big question is fuel. How much will we find, and will it start the engines? I'm not worried about whether a 777 is available. I bet there are 10 of them at Logan, and at least 2 of them in Manchester, maybe more. They drove through the looted and destroyed stretch of Lebanon. Reminds me of Philly, John said to them. Amazing it's so close to Hanover. Yet there's no looting there. Just like the countries, Hanover didn't let Lebanon in. Peter turned back around and faced forward. The world was pretty selfish towards the end. Love thy neighbor became avoid thy neighbor. They were quiet as they remembered the rapture. It was easy to not think about it as they moved forward with their lives, but impossible to forget as they looked at empty and vandalized streets. So, John broke the silence, which truck should we take tomorrow? Our Suburban or the new lime green Hummer? Both have the capacity to bring people back, but I think the Hummer sends more of a message. Makes me seem a little cooler than the Suburban does. I can pull off the Hummer. You cannot, Solange told him. What? Are you kidding me? I can certainly pull off the Hummer. John looked towards Peter for confirmation. Peter shook his head. What? You too? John, you are a great man, but if I see you getting out of a truck that color, well, I would think you're having a midlife crisis, or you borrowed your wife's car. Peter put his arm on John's shoulder. I see her getting out. I whistle. The rest of the 5-minute drive home was spent arguing, John futilely defending his ability to pull off a lime-green car. Peter and Solange laughed at him. They drove up to the main house, and John got out and walked over to Matt. Matt, I'm thinking of taking the Hummer tomorrow. You think I can pull it off? Huh! No. Matt tossed a Nerf football with Craig, Avery, Meredith, and Greg. Dad, come on, you're more of a Suburban guy. Actually, Greg looked around. A Volvo sedan. Everyone nodded. I can't believe this. Solange, we are taking that green Hummer, and I am driving. Okay, but if we find people, they will believe it is my car. Ahmed, Hank, and Paul pulled up 2 hours later. They were grinning from ear to ear.
We found cows. We found quite a few animals, actually. Some cows, pigs. Most of the animals starved, but a few were able to find enough food. They're thin and weak, but Kelly thinks she can save almost all of them. Hank beamed as he relayed the story. We found some hay and grain that was not rotted, and we fed the animals. Kelly decided to stay. There was a farmhouse with a wood stove and plenty of canned food.
Milk! Can you believe it? We have cows for milk! There's even a bull! We should be able to breed a herd!
Paul crossed his arms in triumph. The tribe enjoyed an Italian feast that night. Despite his previous concerns about the volume it took, Todd made goat's milk ricotta cheese. They grilled Hank's moose sausage and cooked it in jarred marinara sauce with red wine. The pasta was finished in the sauce, and the entire dish was sprinkled with the homemade cheese. The meal of homemade bread, sausage, pasta, sauce, and cheese lifted their spirits. The conversation was fun and lively. A warm breeze blew from the south, and the temperatures stayed in the 40s the entire evening. Spring was coming early to New England. Rebecca told stories of watching plane after plane depart from Manchester at the height of the rapture. There has to be fuel there. A lot of fuel. And I know there are Southwest planes.
Those are 737s. They can go about 3,000 miles, Peter explained. We would get to San Fran on fumes, then have to refuel, and could get to Hawaii from San Fran. We'd have to find gas. What we're looking for, and what I need John and Solange to find, if possible, is a big, big plane, a 777. We could also make it on a 767. That will give us about 1,000 miles or so to spare. But the 777? We could fly to Hawaii and back on a full tank of fuel.
So you're saying we could get lost for a little while?
Emily asked. But if we take one of the smaller ones, we can't get lost for very long. Em, we can't get lost, period. But if we're in a 777, we'll have enough fuel to hit land on the other side of Hawaii. If we aren't in one, it will be close. The table went silent as they all digested their food, and the thought of being lost high in the sky over the Pacific Ocean. 45. John and Solange pulled away from Hanover at 6 a.m. the next morning. They found plane fuel in Lebanon. Their group had livestock. Everything was breaking their way. John rode the accelerator hard on the almost snow-free road, and they made the 65-mile drive to the Manchester, New Hampshire International Airport in 45 minutes. 2 weeks earlier, it was dark at 7 a.m. Today, the sun was over the mountains, and warm light flooded the canyons and valleys. John stopped the car at the entrance to the airfield. He and Solange looked at an arch that spanned the three-lane entrance. Welcome to Manchester Airport. The airport sat on a plateau at the top of a hill. John and Solange sat in the running car at the bottom of the hill. John landed and took off from this airport dozens of times, visiting his parents throughout the years. He knew the area well.
There's a big stuffed moose in the lobby, he told Solange. It was a clean and well-run airport.
I have never been this far north. New York City was as cold as I ever wanted to be, she replied.
Should we just drive around the terminal, bust through any gates we need to, and get over to the runways?
John looked at her with shrugged shoulders.
I do not want to get out until we need to check the fuel trucks. The South American gave a faux shiver of her shoulders.
Rebecca told them about seeing planes take off in September, and how actively the military utilized this airport during the rapture. She did not go to the airport after the plane traffic stopped, and did not know the condition of the area. A green military jeep sat at the bottom of the hill, parked in the middle of the road leading up to the airport. It looked like a checkpoint. There was a second jeep blocking the road leading out of the airport.
It looks like they turned this place into a military base.
John pulled around the checkpoint and headed up the hill. The road spiraled up the slope before straightening out at the top for a clear view of the terminal and the airstrip. Large green military trucks littered the terminal pickup and drop-off loop and were visible on the airfield.
They must have been moving supplies and people. Look at all these transport trucks. John pointed his finger and moved it across the landscape. What are there? 30? 40 trucks? This looks like a military base, not a civilian airport. The left lane was clear for John to pull the lime green truck around the abandoned military transports. You know, you're not allowed to park in the passenger drop-off lane. They're very strict about that. John threw Solange a smile. She was not in a joking mood. The images of the Metropolitan Museum were fresh in her mind, and she anticipated a battle scene similar to the one in New York. She looked for bodies, broken terminal windows, fire damage, but no carnage appeared as they crept around the glass terminal building. The airport consisted of two buildings, a terminal, which they passed on their right, and a parking garage to their left. The garage appeared to be a standard parking structure, 5 levels of concrete built for short-term parking near the terminal. A small parking lot for hourly or employee parking sat between the road and the garage. Large green military tents covered the open lot. It looks like MASH over there, John said out loud. What does that mean? Solange asked him. He stopped the slow-moving car, slid it into park, and turned towards her. What do you mean, what does that mean? MASH. The television show. I have not seen it before. She continued to scan the area, not giving him her full attention. You've never seen or heard of the show MASH? It was the biggest show in the world. More people watched the finale than, like, anything ever. When was that? She asked, facing him. I guess it ended in 1983 or 84. He calculated her age in his head. I was born in 1985. She smiled. I am also from Ecuador. It might not have been shown in my country. I forgot how young you are. But seriously, you should know what MASH is. If it makes you feel better. John's hand was resting on the gear shift handle between the two front seats as she moved her hand over his. I do not think of your age either. She leaned towards him and kissed him on the mouth. Her eyes were closed as she leaned into him. He kissed her back, but his eyes stayed open. It was not a long kiss, but it had passion and meaning. Solange pulled away from him, keeping her face a few inches from his. She opened her eyes. Do you think we should walk through the tents or terminal now that we know this is a military base? She smiled with satisfaction. John was in shock, and his mind was no longer at the airport. John, do you think we should explore the situation, or focus on finding airplanes and fuel? He looked into her brown eyes and beautiful face, still inches from his. Why did you do that? I am sorry, she started. No, no, I'm glad you kissed me. I just didn't expect it. And I don't understand. Her hand still rested on his. He released his grip on the gear shift and interlocked their fingers. I am a woman who takes control of a situation. I like you. I am attracted to you. If this last year has taught me anything, it is that life is fragile, and we must seize opportunity. When you announced you were going to Boston, I decided it was my opportunity to show you how I feel. They held hands and shared the moment before John replied. As easy as it would be for me to kiss you back right now, we have a job to do. We can continue the conversation about us throughout this trip. Let's focus on the task at hand. John squeezed her hand before turning to look at the tents. Let's get out and walk around. It's 42 degrees. It's practically summer temperatures in New Hampshire. They slipped on their winter coats, gloves, and hats. John left the car running as they exited the truck and walked towards the tents. As soon as they opened their doors, they could smell rotting death. The stench was similar to the Central Park grave. It's getting stronger the closer we get to the parking garage. John pointed as he wrapped a scarf tightly around his nose and mouth to minimize the impact. John went ahead of Solange. He felt her hand on his arm and stopped.
That is where the soldiers went to die.
Solange held her left hand over her nose and mouth, pointing to the concrete building with her right index finger. Canvas draped from the top of the parking garage to the ground floor, tenting the entire structure as if they were fumigating for termites. Corners of the canvas fell open in spots. Even from their distance, Solange and John could see corpses ravaged by animals and birds.
Okay, note to self. Don't go in the garage.
He nodded at her and gave a thumbs up. Do you want to go back to the truck? You've seen this movie before. No need for you to deal with it again.
I am okay, but yes, I am not going into the parking garage.
John expected to see the corner of her eyes crinkled from a smile after her witty comment. Solange's face, blocked by a scarf in similar fashion to John's, did not move. She was not comfortable or happy. John was not sure why he was outside of his truck. He had food. He had water. He did not need guns or ammunition. He was going to the tents to satisfy his curiosity. He yearned to know how the military handled the last few weeks. How close was the government to a cure? Could he decipher the last days of their world from what was behind the curtain? He reached the tent, looked at Solange, took a breath, and pulled back the flap. It was another bunkhouse. The smell hit him in the face like a baseball bat. He dropped the tent canvas and stumbled back.
More bodies, he gagged as he told her. There's nothing here. Let's get back in the truck and get the hell out of here.
He motioned with his hand for her to walk back to the truck. Let's find a plane. Find available fuel and let the dead rest in peace.
You will get no argument from me, she said,
her voice muffled by the scarf around her mouth. They walked back to the Hummer quickly, jumping into the car as soon as they could. The air was fresher inside, but the rotting smell crept into the vehicle. John let out a sigh.
I bet there are a couple of hundred people over there. We should get to the other side of the terminal, Solange recommended.
John put the Hummer into drive. They moved away from the garage, their eyes turned to the right, looking through the airport building's glass walls for any clues, and averting their eyes from the mass grave that was the Manchester parking area. A restricted access sign stood on the right side of the road to the airfield at the end of the terminal building. A large metal gate swung from a pole on the right side, locking into a pole on the left. Today, the gate was open. John followed the road to the end of the terminal and out onto the tarmac. The military used armed guards in jeeps as sentries instead of gates and fences. With the people dead, the airstrip was open.
Well, that was easy, John commented as they drove on the tarmac side of the airport.
Empty terminal gates were giant rectangular holes in the glass walls. The passenger ramps were retracted and snug against the building.
Lucky for us, no one was left to lock the door.
She nodded. Lucky for us indeed. He pointed to four large fuel trucks with white cylinder tanks on their backs. John made his way to the vehicles. The tarmac and runway were almost clear of snow. Puddles and islands of drifts dotted the concrete landscape, but the plateau of the airport and slanted design of the runway rid the area of snow naturally.
I got this. You stay inside. No use both of us dealing with the cold and smelly air.
He opened his door, jumped out quickly, and shut it before too much foul air could rush in. The trucks were similar in look and shape to the one in Lebanon, but they were much larger, used for large commercial jets rather than commuter planes. John knew where to look for the fuel capacity gauge on the side of the white tanker. The gauges were not dependent on power. The first truck's needle was between half and three-quarters full. The other three trucks were full. As he checked each truck and found fuel, he gave thumbs up. When he saw the fourth truck was full, he put both of his arms in the air and danced in circles. He jogged back over to the Hummer and hopped in quickly.
We're set. Three full, one two-thirds. Plenty of fuel.
What was that? Solange asked him with a frown.
What was what? John replied, confused.
Your little dance. What was that?
Rocky Balboa at the top of the steps in Philly.
It's cool.
No, she said, sitting forward in her seat. That was a bad Rocky. You looked like Mary Tyler Moore throwing her hat in the air. It was not what a man should do.
You know Mary Tyler Moore, but you don't know MASH? How is that possible?
My father liked strong female role models. He ordered Mary Tyler Moore tapes, and we watched them together, she told him. We still need to find a plane.
I know there's a plane at Logan. I hope we can find one here, but finding fuel was the key. We can figure out the plane situation.
You watched Mary Tyler Moore with your father?
I did.
She scanned the horizon as he asked her the question. Over there, she pointed to a group of planes. It looks like the military moved all of the commercial planes over there.
John followed her finger to a grouping of planes. A dozen white jets of various sizes rested near a few brown UPS planes.
All right, let's go check it out.
He slipped the Hummer into drive and headed towards the parking lot of planes at the end of the main runway a quarter of a mile away. Some of the planes were parked on the grass next to the security fence. As they drove closer, they noticed the size differences. There were two enormous jets dwarfing the others. John and Solange assumed these two were the 777s needed for their trip. There were eight smaller planes, the same size as the three UPS planes, parked towards the end of the fence. Seven smaller jets and turboprop planes were further off the runway. John pulled directly behind the behemoths.
Three sets of wheels on each side, exactly as Peter told us. Solange nodded to the landing gear.
Well, if we want to go to Hawaii, it appears we have a way to get there.
John put the Hummer in reverse, turned it around, and headed back down the runway.
Let's get out of here. This place is a giant graveyard.
We can send Peter down with a group. He can see if the plane will start and get it fueled.
She paused.
If we decide we want to go to Hawaii.
What's your take on that? What do you think we should do? Should we risk our lives on a plane to get to paradise?
Solange took a deep breath, thinking about the question.
I think so, yes.
John gave her a quick glance.
That's it.
Yes?
You're cut and dry on your opinion?
I am. I believe we can thrive there. There are no predators. There is food, fish, vegetables, fruit, water. It is warm. It has rain. It has sun.
I believe it is a risk, but the risk is worth the reward.
Peter is confident and appears capable. If the fuel works, we should go while we can.
I agree, John told her.
Did you ever watch any of the survivalist shows?
The reality show about people voting each other off? She asked.
No, the ones where they would drop people, usually one guy, maybe a couple of people, in a remote location, and he or they would need to survive for a few days, maybe a week. Did you ever see those?
The Men Who Fought the Wild, she replied back.
Yes, those are the shows, exactly. Anyway, whenever they're on a tropical island where it isn't cold, it's child's play for those people. As long as they have water, they can go forever on a tropical island. There are fish. They catch crabs. They have bananas and pineapples. It was almost a joke.
John left the runway area, traveling through the old checkpoint and back onto the public road leading out of the airport and to the highway.
Put that against the ones where they're stuck in Canada in the winter. There's no food. There's almost no heat. They struggle to find firewood and fuel.
It's scary to think about us trying to get through a harsh winter 3 or 4 years down the road. All of our canned or boxed food is gone, and we're relying on crops and canning, maybe hunting to feed a group of at least 22 people.
They turned out of the airport toward the highway to Boston.
Solange, I think we need to take this flight to Hawaii. I don't think it's a choice. In my mind, it is get to Hawaii, or die in 5 years.
He turned up the entrance ramp to the highway.
As I said, Solange told him, I think we need to go.
It was 7:30 a.m. as they made their way towards Boston. In just 30 minutes, they had secured fuel and found two planes suitable for a flight to a Hawaiian island. The Manchester runway was clear.
and their destiny would be set if the fuel worked.
We have a few minutes, John said to her. How about talking about us for the rest of the trip?
I enjoy the sound of us. What would you like to discuss?
You don't think the age difference is an issue? John asked her, baffled that this beautiful woman in her 20s kissed him a half hour ago.
I do not have many options.
Your brother Todd is taken. You are the next logical choice.
So I'm just a consolation prize.
Solange laughed.
You are a strong, confident man who rescued me from a bad situation. You are a good leader for our group, and you give off a masculine quality that I find handsome. I have never dated an older man, but I find you interesting and attractive, and I want to spend more time with you. I find myself missing you when we are apart. I did not propose to you, but I would like to explore a relationship and see where we might go. She rested her hand on his thigh. I married the love of my life when I was in college. I haven't looked at another woman since then. I do like you, and I'm attracted to you, and I find myself drawn to you when we're in the same company. But you have to take it slow with me. I'm not ready for anything fast, and I want to make sure my boys are ready for me to date.
Of course, Solange said.
So if I asked you to pull the car over and fold down the back seats?
John looked at her, his head turning away from the road. She rubbed his leg higher. He lifted his foot off the accelerator, and the Hummer slowed to a stop on the highway. 30 minutes later, the two lay together under an L.L. Bean flannel duvet cover, basking in the glow of their new relationship.
So that's what you consider taking it slow. Interesting.
Life is too short for slow. She faced away from him, her naked body pressed against him. Her eyes were closed, and she wore a grin. Her head was on a soft flannel pillow packed for their night in Boston. The car sat in the middle of Highway 493, still running. John reached up and turned off the engine. The sun was higher in the sky, but the outdoor temperature crept into the Hummer. Solange pulled him tightly around her to keep warm.
John was conflicted.
He still wore his wedding ring, honoring his wife of over 20 years. But that life was gone. He felt a pull to Solange, a desire for her as a woman, but also for the new life she represented, a life of love, respect, and passion. He decided to enjoy the moment, to live in the now, and he squeezed her when she pulled him closer.
"Do you mind if we take a nap together? Just for a little while?"
she asked him softly. He kissed her on the back of her neck.
"We have all the time in the world."
She gave a satisfied sound and drifted off to sleep. They awoke an hour later, making love again in the cold car under a warm flannel blanket. After a few moments of tenderness, she asked him to start the car and heat the interior so she could get dressed.
"But I'm cold, too. Why do I have to start the car?" he asked her, as he slipped out from under the warmth of the double flannel sheet.
"Because you are the man, and that is what men do."
"I see how this relationship is going," he said,
pulling on his clothes as quickly as he could to escape the cold air of the car.
"I think you will do just fine," she said from under the blanket.
He knew she was right, and he sat patiently as the inside warmed enough for her to climb out from under the covers. John watched her get dressed, looking at her body as it went from naked to wearing tight jeans and a cashmere sweater. He enjoyed watching her. Solange noticed and smiled, slowing down to let him soak it all in. She knew she was beautiful, desirable to men. She had always been. But she rarely returned affections. She was genuinely taken with this man, and she let him enjoy her however he wanted. If he liked watching her dress, she would dress slowly.
"Stop looking at me that way,
unless you want to turn the car off again." She made her way from the back seat to the front.
"I'm sorry, it's just, you're very pretty, and I, well,"
he stammered like a teenager.
"I enjoy your gaze. I am just warning you that your gaze has consequences.
John took a moment to compose himself. Okay, let's focus on our job for a moment. We need to get to Boston before dark. He put the Hummer into drive and pushed down on the gas. The tires squealed as the truck jumped out of their parking spot. A few minutes later, they were on Interstate 93 South, towards Boston.
What do you think? Philadelphia or Washington, D.C.? She asked him, referencing a dead city in ruins and an intact metropolis with survivors.
I think Washington. Judging from all the military we just saw, I bet they had Boston under wraps. I doubt it got out of control like Philly. Who knows? Maybe that's why the military was staging up in Manchester instead of at Logan.
I have never been to Boston, and know little about the city. Where should we go?
Is there a good spot to light a fire and signal the rest of the city? It's pretty spread out, but it's also flat. I've spent some time there. We can start in Beacon Hill or Back Bay. There's a big park with ponds for ducks. Maybe lighting a fire will create a scene. We've gotten pretty lucky the last three times we've looked for people. Hopefully we haven't used up all of our luck. He drove quickly down the highway.
Let me know when you're hungry for lunch. Todd made a large sausage sandwich for us to share.
She drank from one of their water bottles and offered him a sip when she was done. He took the bottle and drank. The drive from Manchester to Boston was quick. John unknowingly benefited from the military keeping the highway clear to link the airports for troop and supply movement. John and Solange used the car time to learn more about each other. John knew almost nothing about Ecuador. He asked about her life, her family, why she was in the U.S. to study. John wanted to know everything. Solange was open about her life, her family's money, her privileged upbringing. She talked about her siblings, her parents, her country. She had a softer side, one that John had not seen, and it came out as she spoke. Her rapture story was similar to Jamie's. Solange was in school when the epidemic hit Brazil, and all intercontinental travel stopped. She was stuck in Richmond, Virginia at VCU, alone, separated from everyone and everything she loved.
"I'm sorry," John said to her, putting his hand on her leg as she talked about losing her family.
I am too.
She did not cry.
What makes me most sad, what keeps me up at night when I am not exhausted from the day, is the idea that I will never see any of it again. I will never step foot in my house. I will never see my dogs or say hello to my Nana. I cannot play football with my brothers and sisters and cousins, and I will not hug my mother or father. I never got to say goodbye to anything. I was up here on an adventure, a 6-month trip for fun because I am a spoiled rich girl, and my decision to experience the United States at the wrong time means I lost the ability to see everything and everyone I loved ever again.
I think about your son, Greg. He was at school and did not get to say goodbye to his mother or his friends. But I am one step further. I did not get to say goodbye to my homeland, my country, my continent.
She paused for a moment, sighing with a deep breath.
But I have made peace with it. I cannot change the way my life is gone. I am moving forward.
She clasped his hand, still resting on her leg.
I have found you. I have found a new family, and we will make a new home. I decided to not feel sad about my loss, to only make my thoughts of my family and home happy thoughts, to make their memories happy memories, honoring the time. I had a truly great life, and while that part is over, I can be happy it was filled with love.
Solange's mixture of heartache for the past and hope for the future was the norm among the tribe. She had her moments of sorrow, black hours of loss and depression, but as her time with the group continued, her optimism and spirit grew.
"How old are you again?"
John asked in a tone that let her know it was a rhetorical question.
"Living alone in a strange city in a strange country adds years to your maturity. When I say alone,
I mean, there is literally no one else.
She squeezed his hand. Boston was on the horizon.